Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie truthers. Welcome to this week's episode of Truth in Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Adam Woodward.
And I'm Cheyenne Buncey.
On the show this week, Indiana Jones returns for The Dial of Destiny, and Hannah Strong got to talk to its star, Mads Mikkelsen. A family comes together and falls apart in Mother and Son. And on Film Club, we get to revisit Indiana Jones's early entry, Temple of Doom. All coming up in Truth in Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, Shay, lovely to have you back. What have you been up to?
Hello. Nice. Thank you for having me back. I've been well. What have I been up to? Honestly, I think it's been kind of like everybody who writes for a living, eyeing up AI a little bit, kind of like, hi there. Like, can we work together? I'd rather not. But yes, I've been doing what I usually do, doing some writing for some publications. So I'm a freelance writer, been doing stuff for Massive Cinema and, of course, you guys at Little White Lies. But yeah, I've been looking over my shoulder at AI and keeping well.
Yeah, got it. I mean, aside from it doing all my transcribing for me, I mean, if we can keep that element, that would be absolutely great, because I don't want to go back to the misery of listening to something and typing for like 2 hours.
That's very fair, because that is very soul destroying.
Adam, what about you? Been up to anything fun?
Yeah, all good, thanks. Well, we're all hard at work on the 100th issue of Little White Lies at Little White Lies Tower. So yeah, we got the new one out at the moment, Asteroid City, which has obviously just been in cinemas, and we're kind of now in sort of pre-production mode, I guess, on the next issue, which is our 100th issue, which is pretty special. So can't really reveal any details of that just yet, but we'll have more to come.
And that's kind of looking at a bit of an autumn, assuming that we get to have the delights of that.
Yeah, so I think this issue is going to be on shelf a little bit longer. We kind of usually do that over the summer period because there's fewer films that come out, really. You've got your kind of big, you've got your Barbies and Oppenheimers and Mission Impossibles, and then it's a bit of a kind of lull over the summer. So we try and keep that issue on shelf a bit longer. So we're aiming for like early autumn release for this one.
And I am excited for the party. I have kept the date in my diary and I will be jumping out of a cake if required. But yeah, I mean, speaking of the summer, we do at least have Sundance London to look forward to, which is going to be the 6th to the 9th of July. We get to see some of the titles that premiered back in January when I was doing this festival virtually. What do we got? We got Talk to Me, which is like a really gnarly horror film that was brilliant. The new Nicole Holofcener. So anything you guys are particularly looking forward to?
Definitely the new Nicole Holofcener, and also is Past Lives going to be there? Because I believe that is like my number one.
I think so, yeah.
Cannot wait. Need to see.
That was one of the ones that they kept from us kind of virtual attendees. It was kind of so treasured that you actually had to go to Utah to see it. So, but yeah, I've heard only the best things about that one.
Yeah, I think Scrapper as well was on my to watch list. I've heard good things about that, which is a British film, but premiered in Sundance earlier this year. So, and it's all at Picturehouse Central again, right?
It is indeed. Yeah, it's going to be a really good one. I mean, Sundance was like really strong this year when it came to like British female debuts. I mean, not just Scrapper, but Rye Lane, and also subject of the past issue, Polite Society. So, lots of reasons to be hopeful about the state of the movies. But yeah, we should move on to the movies that are out this week for people. First up, one of the big summer blockbusters, Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny.
Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. Receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. Finding himself in a new era, approaching retirement, Indy wrestles with fitting into a world that seems to have outgrown him. But as the tentacles of an all-too-familiar evil return in the form of an old rival, Indy must don his hat and pick up his whip once more to make sure an ancient and powerful artifact doesn't fall into the wrong hands. But before we get into the film, here's Hannah Strong talking to Mads Mikkelsen, who plays Jürgen Voller, a former Nazi during World War II who has been hired by NASA and seeks to use the Apollo moon landing program for his own gain.
I'd like to start by asking you about your relationship with Indiana Jones, if you had one when you were younger.
I definitely had. I actually don't know anyone in my generation who doesn't. I think that was the film that we all saw. That was the film that defined our generations. Some of us became film people, and basically everyone was inspired to be that because of Indiana Jones. I watched it with my brother when I was 15, VHS, five other films, but we never saw them. We just watched Indy over and over again. So yeah, that was a love story right away.
Did you have like that starstruck moment when you met Harrison Ford?
Not really. I mean, I didn't really meet Harrison. Actually, I met Indiana Jones because he just came out of his trailer with the hat and everything. We were just supposed to have a meeting, actually. So I got a little starstruck watching that, I gotta be honest. He makes it easy. You don't get starstruck with him. He makes everything very grounded and makes sure that we can make a good scene together.
What was it about the first lot of films, like, you know, Temple of Doom and Ark of the Covenant and whatnot, that really grabbed you and your brother? I'm interested in...
It's just a fairy tale, of course. It's a fairy tale. You want to be Indiana Jones. You want to go up there. It's kind of scary, but it's not really scary. And he always makes it at the end of the day. Those first 10, 12 minutes of Raiders of the Lost Ark, it's just mind-blowing. It just blows you away. So I don't think any start in any film has been that efficient for a whole generation.
I mean, certainly when I first saw it with my parents when I was about 8, I had a very similar kind of, this is what a movie can be, this is what we can do in cinema.
I agree. I mean, it was so much happening in 10 minutes, introducing a character, a plot, a universe. It was fantastic.
Of course, in this film, you have an homage to the beginning of Raiders. I would love to kind of hear about filming that scene, which is very intense and a lot kind of happens in a very short space of time. You're doing a lot of kind of like... So between that and towards the end of the film, it's like the big stunt work.
It was a tricky scene. I don't know, I think we spent maybe 3-4 weeks because it's on this train. We've got to keep track constantly. Where are we? We'll have to jump back and forth, obviously. But so it's shot up and now it's blown up and where's my hat? Oh, the suitcase is there. So that's a lot of puzzles that has to fit in there. And on top of that, I had to speak German. So that was some brutal days.
You don't speak German in real life, so that was like another...
Not fluently, no. I have to pick it up.
They're not at all.
They have a familiarity, certain words, but the grammar and the pronunciations are completely different.
Yeah, I lived there for a year and I still don't speak German. No. Luckily, everyone over there was lovely and spoke English. So they didn't care about me being ignorant British person. I know that you're kind of typecast a little bit in Hollywood movies as the kind of villainous, stylish European. What is it appeals to you about playing the quote-unquote bad guy?
Oh, it can be a lot of different things, right? The story has to be something, obviously, that I relate to. This is a no-brainer. It's Indiana Jones. I would have played a cat if they asked me. Then I've done, obviously, James Bond. That's also a no-brainer to be asked to do that. Hannibal Lecter is a very different animal. You get to spend 3 years with a character that eventually is not looked upon as a villain by the audience.
So no,
which is
not
a
at
very,
all.
Very interesting process, right? So for me, it's just different angles. Are there different stories? Can we do a little different thing than we did last time? So just grateful that they're still asking.
And with kind of research, I know that there are some actors who love to kind of go deep in and do kind of extensive processes. How do you like to kind of approach when it's something like this? It's very much rooted in something that is fact, something that did happen after the war.
Yeah, I mean, the stories are there. We know for a fact that a lot of German scientists went straight to America or straight to the Soviet Union. And it's not the kind of film where it's a portrait and a real story thing. It's just inspired. So if we were going into that heart of darkness, I would have done a different kind of research. But we looked at photos of Wernher von Braun, and were puzzled by the way he could just carry himself around really dandy. Nobody questioned him. He didn't even change his name. So that way of just sliding into the American society, we were inspired by his look.
It was very, like, again, an homage to the original films and the kind of the scene that is, like, really seared into my brain of the melting Nazi face from the Ark of the Covenant.
Yeah, like,
I think that scarred me quite a lot as a child.
All of us. I mean, he's a wonderful actor who brought this character to life. It's just something you don't want to copy because...
Only
a few people can get away with that.
You've done, obviously, a couple of these big films. Now, you mentioned working on James Bond as well, and obviously Hannibal, which is a big budget TV series. But I know, obviously, from watching your European films that you love to kind of do smaller films and work at very different scales. How important is it to you to have that balance between making something as iconic as an Indiana Jones movie and then going away and working on something that's a lot smaller?
It's not the size of the film that's attracting me. It's because it's obviously my language. It's my stories. It's my friends. So we have a tie together that's a little different. So we can push each other in different directions than you might be asked to do in other places.
Speaking of your friends, do you and Nicholas Winding Refn have anything up your sleeves?
Not that I know of, but I know for sure one day we will work together again.
Good. I mean, I'm desperate for him to make another movie, as I'm sure everyone is. I can't wait. If you could go back in time and meet any historical figure, who would it be and why?
Genghis Khan.
Really?
Yeah.
He's a scary man.
Yeah. But I said it before, he's just have this reputation of being pretty cool. It's like with all the horrendous stuff he's done, I mean, killed millions of people, I don't know how many, raped. He still has some PR people who are doing a hell of a job, you know. And so it'd be fun to see how, also just interesting to see that period.
Yeah.
It's just like how he gathered all these small groups of clans, and interesting.
It's a very mythologized period. Yeah, it is. Like seeing the reality. Like, so, I mean, I guess it's the same with ancient Rome, ancient Greece.
Sure, and there's a ton of places. Go back to Egypt and figure out how they build the pyramids. That's a lot of questions.
Finally get the answer.
Get the answer, yeah.
Lovely. Thank you very much. It's great to meet you. And I love the film. That's great.
Good.
It's delightful.
So, Adam, did you come into this as a big Indiana Jones fan? I mean, what did you think of kind of previous entries?
Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, they were a pretty permanent fixture, I'd say, of my childhood. And even, I would describe myself as a Crystal Skull apologist as of about a week ago when I revisited it, because I hadn't seen it since it came out in the cinemas, whenever that was, 10 or so years ago. And I'd kind of written it off at the time, but revisiting it now, I know we're going to go back to an even earlier one in the kind of mid-chapter of the original trilogy later on. But yeah, Crystal Skull, I thought was better on a second watch, actually. So my expectations for this one, I think, were helped a little bit by that. But definitely a big indie fan going into this, and a huge Harrison Ford fan. And I got to say, he's still got it. I mean, he's in his 80s now. He totally brings that old kind of Hollywood stardom, that little sprinkle of stardust that you need in a film like this. And I just think he's brilliant. He's such good value. He's kind of grown into this. I mean, the character was always a little bit curmudgeonly and a little bit grouchy. And I think it really suits him now. He's like really wearing that well with his age. And just the kind of setup of him now being slightly older and not quite past it, but he's in this new era, as you say, and it's kind of teed up in early on with him. But is it the kind of like late 60s, early 70s? I can't remember the exact era, but it's around that sort of time. But there's straight away you get the sense that he's slightly out of step with the rest of the world and the kind of the hippie pot smoking youth of the day. So yeah, I think it's a really good setup. It's nice to kind of revisit this old character, and also other old characters who we shouldn't spoil, but it's nice to see some sort of familiar faces popping up in this as well.
Yeah, it does seem that with Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, they did kind of take the note that nobody liked Shia LaBeouf's character in that. And so instead we get Phoebe Waller-Bridge in that kind of role of, she's his goddaughter, isn't that right?
Yeah, and it's, I mean, you mentioned Shia LaBeouf's character. It's interesting because it has this kind of Rear Window-esque opening kind of quick pan through his apartment, and it just, in a couple of shots, kind of brings you up to speed with what's happened in Indy's life since Crystal Skull. And it's actually quite a nice little bit of visual exposition there, which kind of explains why Shia LaBeouf's not in this one. And so, yeah, enter Phoebe Waller-Bridge as the kind of, I guess you could maybe broadly describe her as the sidekick, although I think that the nice thing about her role here, she's given maybe more to do, slightly more to do than the kind of Indy female protagonists of old. She's bit more of an ambiguous character. You know, she's not quite a kind of femme fatale, but she's certainly not a damsel in distress. And I think Phoebe Waller-Bridge plays the character really nicely. So she's playing his goddaughter, and they kind of team up, but they've got kind of different motives, and they're kind of chasing the same thing. And it's that classic setup, really, of them. You know, they end up kind of helping each other on this mission, but there's this constant kind of needling and sort of bantering between the two of them, which I really like. And there's only a couple of moments in the film where she slips into sort of Fleabag territory, but otherwise I'd say this is like, yeah, really actually I thought was like a really impressive, like brought a lot of kind of charm and energy, and it's just like a really nice foil for Harrison Ford in this.
I mean, normally with these films, Shay, they kind of have like the MacGuffin, the thing that they are after. But in this case, the Dial of Destiny itself is a bit more central to the plot than just kind of the thing we need to get. Did all of that kind of, the plot machinations that we shouldn't give away that it created work for you?
Yeah, they did. They did work for me. I feel like, yes, this is very central to the plot. And also, again, not to give things away, you kind of, I feel like I had a better understanding of it as the kind of center of the plot because of their, shall we say, exposure to it. Whereas before, sometimes it's more, you never really see it, or it's just something that they're journeying towards, so you're a bit distant towards it. Full disclosure, before this podcast, I had not seen any Indiana Jones films.
Oh, wow.
Yes, I had not seen a single one. So for this podcast, I decided that I was just going to watch all of them in one go, which I actually enjoyed. Different to Adam, like they were like never on in my house. So obviously I knew what they were, but I had just was never really familiar with the character of Indy. So like this was a nice, like compact experience. So just seeing them one kind of after the other with very little pause, everything kind of progressed in a different way for me.
That's amazing that you, did you literally do them all in one hit?
So I did the first two in one day, and then the other ones like in just concurrent days up until the actual like going to see Dial of Destiny. But yeah, my actual reason, I believe anyway, that I never watched Indiana Jones growing up is that my mum didn't really like Harrison Ford.
What?
I know, yeah. She was, according to her, it was either Harrison Ford or Richard Gere for her, and she was a Gere woman. So there was no Indiana Jones on when I was younger. She wasn't, so yeah, I guess I just grew up and then it just wasn't a thing to me. So yeah, but it's good to join, better late than never.
Oh, but this is like a Rolling Stones versus Beatles thing. Like, you don't have to choose.
I mean, this is what I said to her, but for her, that was the choice that she made, and it has clearly influenced my life.
So we've got to ask, now that you've done all of them, how are you going to rank them?
Oh, okay, because I thought about this. So for me, the top spot is kind of between Raiders and Last Crusade, because I enjoyed the kind of Sean Connery of it all in Last Crusade. Again, we'll talk about Temple of Doom. I think coming off the back of Temple of Doom, it was a lot more fun, lighthearted, kind of, again, capturing what Raiders was. So, but for now, I think I'll go Raiders, Last Crusade, Dial of Destiny, Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, which, yeah, I was kind of looking at Dial of Destiny as, will it be better than Kingdom of the Crystal Skull? Which for me, it was.
Well, that's something at least. A little bit damning with faint praise. But, I mean, these movies are fun, but they're also kind of Spielberg movies. So there's a high expectation coming into them. I mean, do you think that like James Mangold was able to kind of make his own mark on it? Or was he just kind of replicating what came before?
I feel like yes, because they are very, very much like Spielberg movies. So even watching across the series, watching them, even when I wasn't like 100% necessarily into what was going on, I was like, damn, these movies are made just incredibly like Spielberg. This is why Spielberg is Spielberg. I think Mangold did a very good job. I feel like maybe he didn't necessarily try and replicate the Spielberg magic. He just again, made a very competent, well-crafted film. I liked the action sequences. Again, I wouldn't say they're Spielbergish, but they were very good. So yeah, I think he did the right thing in trying to not copy everything, but I don't know if it's necessarily putting his unique stamp on it. But that may not be what the film called for, because at the end of the day, it's about Indiana Jones. It's Harrison Ford's last Indiana Jones film for now, I guess. So yeah, you did a good job there.
Yeah, I'd co-sign that. I think he crucially doesn't try to emulate Spielberg too much, but he definitely follows the blueprint of like Raiders and just this sense and this idea of Indy and the whole plot being in this kind of constant state of forward momentum and forward motion. I mean, I would say it's the longest film in the series, right, by some distance. It's like 2.5 hours, which it does have a bit of a pacing issue, but I would say it does kind of always kind of lead nicely onto the next thing. And you know, there's no kind of overlong set pieces, I didn't feel. I mean, in Crystal Skull, one of the things, I mean, the jungle, like the car chase through the jungle is almost like excruciatingly overwrought and overlong. And you know, and that's Spielberg. So I actually think he kind of does well, Mangold, to avoid some of that. And he tips his hat to some of the kind of the more templated aspects of these films. Like you've got the kind of A to B map sequence, which is obviously a kind of a nod to Casablanca in the originals. And actually, there's definitely a sense that Mangold's gone back and rewatched like Casablanca and some of the films that Spielberg was kind of drawing from in the originals. So I think it has like a nice sensibility. My biggest gripe, and actually it's rare for a film to lose me before you've even seen like the first proper shot of the film, but the company logos at the start, you know, famously has this kind of amazing match cut from the Paramount logo into the first proper shot from the film, and this is the first film in the series not to have that, because I think there's some nonsense, you know, contractual issue between Disney, who are now distributing this film, and Paramount. So you get the Paramount logo followed by the Lucasfilm logo followed by the first shot of the film, which I can't even remember what it is now, because I was just so apoplectic in the cinema watching it. I mean, it's like the one thing I was looking forward to above anything else was that little kind of Easter egg. So it's a bit of a shame that they don't have that. But I think, yeah, it definitely kind of won me back eventually.
Gotta say, the thing that I was quite surprised that came back, because obviously these earlier films were made in a certain time with, you know, certain ideas about representation, whatever. But I don't get why they brought back John Rhys-Davies to be Salah. I mean, that I found pretty like jarring. Like, you can kind of accept that brownface was a thing that people didn't realize was bad, maybe, like back when these first ones were being made. But like, that was unsettling.
He's always been a curious character, I think, because he's this sort of Egyptian fixer with a kind of rich Midwalian baritone. He's never really seemed like a character that would kind of exist in the real world. It's a very odd character. And I think, you know, I can see the appeal of bringing back a character like that, or bringing back an actor like that as kind of one for the fans. And I'm not really sure you could bring that particular actor back in a new role, right? I mean, it has to be, it's that or nothing. But yeah, I'd say there would be more kind of dubious characters you could bring back, and most of them are dead. Most of the kind of, apart from like some of the other sidekicks, which as I say, they kind of, you know, make excuses for certain people not returning for this one, and some of the actors are literally dead, right? So it's a tricky one. I think I can understand them wanting to bring back that character, but for what he actually contributes to the film, I'm not sure it was that broadly necessary. But having said that, I think it does play nicely into this idea of like, and this is carried throughout the whole series, but I think it's really prominent here. And I think partly why the film works a little bit more or a little bit better on an emotional level compared to like Crystal Skull is this just this idea of like found family. You have that with the Phoebe Waller-Bridge character and another young character that she is almost like her sidekick. Phoebe Waller-Bridge is the daughter of Toby Jones's character in this, who's new to the series but kind of old friend of Indy's. And yeah, there's a lot of kind of you know, thematically it's dipping into kind of reunion and yeah, found family and all this stuff. So, and you know, that's obviously like quite kind of openly sentimental, and I didn't begrudge it for that, I wouldn't say.
Well, I mean, I do not, if you want to kind of keep onto those warm and fuzzy feelings, I recommend not Googling what Jonathan Rhys-Davies has said about Islam. Moving on to less problematic there, Nazis. Shay, how did you find Mads all at the centre of this as our kind of dastardly former Nazi and his terrible schemes?
Yes, I enjoyed him. I feel like, I mean, I love Mads Mikkelsen, who doesn't? And he is the kind of go-to guy. Yes, you know, he does play roles that are not villainous, but as we've seen, like, you know, in kind of what Fantastic Beasts, and he's kind of like the one that where it's like, and also I think to less effect, but in I think the first Doctor Strange, where he was like Caecilius. Don't blame
the
you for not remembering.
The existential crisis, he wanted to live forever.
Yeah, he had like purple glitter on his eyes. But he's become that guy that, like, yes, if you want like a good villain or competent villain, because it depends on how you write them, to come in, then Mads is the guy. I think he did well here. He was a very kind of cool, collected kind of Nazi. Like, I mean, you know, we do get to see flashes of him in the beginning, kind of, and then some time passes when he then, you know, is older with Indiana as well, and trying to pretend that he's not a Nazi, which is also interesting. There were some parts where, again, I think this is just me being a fan of Mads Mikkelsen, where I would have maybe liked to see him be a little bit less controlled, just because I feel like that would be fun, and I think it would be, he'd be good at it. But again, like, he was very competent. He did what he came to do. And he was quite sinister in certain scenes. And again, he was a good kind of indicator as someone who knew Indy back when they were younger and now seeing the passage of time. And again, it's kind of feeding into, you know, time has moved on. And for him as well, he represents more so almost than Indiana lost time and wanting to kind of go back in a very major way and change things and back to a certain kind of perceived heyday. So that was also very interesting to see as well. And I think he got that across really well.
That was some of the most skillful dancing around spoilers
I've
heard in a long time.
But yeah, he, I mean, his whole thing is like, we lost the war. Oh no, we didn't lose the war. Hitler lost the war. So he's kind of bummed that Hitler, you know, dropped the ball basically. But he doesn't, I mean, you don't really get a sense of like what he would do differently or what, you know, what his kind of vision for the Third Reich would be. But it's kind of enough to just have him there as this kind of de facto kind of, you know, unrepentant kind of Nazi. And you kind of introduce, as you mentioned, with this kind of this prologue, which is a nice nod, I think, to The Last Crusade, actually, with this kind of great train chase and a slightly younger Indy than we see in the rest of the film. It does slip slightly into like Uncanny Valley territory a little bit with the digital de-aging. I guess they would have done the same on Mads, right? But for some reason, I think maybe it's just with makeup with him, because I think he looks a bit more like normal, and you buy that a bit more than the young Harrison. It's just something a bit off about it.
I think it might be something to do with Harrison's voice, where he sounds his age. So even with the de-aging, it kind of doesn't feel like a young man.
Yeah, because I was watching this with Hannah Strong, and I kind of whispered to her, his voice doesn't sound right. Is it someone else's voice, like trying to do a younger? But do you think they've like digitally de-aged his voice as well?
I think some shenanigans have been had, but yeah, I did find it not entirely convincing, but you can kind of forgive it in such a kind of heightened world such as this. But yeah, let's get some scores on this before we move on. Adam, do you want to go first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, I think anticipation would probably be about 3 based on the recent rewatch of Crystal Skull. And actually, I think Mangold is a fairly safe pair of hands. And David Cupp, who's one of the screenwriters, has been involved. He's involved in a few of these and has worked with Spielberg quite a lot in the past on like Jurassic Park and stuff like that. So I always felt like they had the kind of right team in place. Definitely in enjoyment, lost the star immediately with the lack of the Paramount logo match cut, I'm afraid. So I'd probably, yeah, let's give it a 3 again for enjoyment. I think it has enough there for fans of the series returning to this world without kind of falling too much into just crude fan service, basically. I think it is its own thing enough. But yeah, maybe a 2 in retrospect. I think it's like, it's fine, but it's a bit long and not really sure it holds up to any of the original trilogy.
Shay, what about you?
Yeah, so for anticipation, as someone who had not seen any of these films about a week and a half ago, a 2. But also, I think especially because I didn't have the connection to the films, it was kind of like, oh, another cash grab, everything's a sequel. So that was my anticipation. But enjoyment, I'd give it a 3. I liked the action. I feel like this was the film where, because of it was dealing with Indy being older, I felt like I finally had a connection to the character. And I think Phoebe Waller-Bridge was very well deployed. However, there were issues with the pacing, definitely in the middle, which I think then brings my overall to 3. So a solid improvement. improvement from Crystal Skull. But yeah, the pacing was not great.
Yeah, I think I'm at about a 3-4-3 as well. I mean, Phoebe Waller-Bridge, Jez Butterworth coming on. I mean, he's one of my favourite playwrights of all time. It was quite...
See, the guy that wrote Jerusalem.
It was intriguing. He wrote Jerusalem and he wrote The Ferryman, which are both excellent. But yeah, it was just kind of nice to be reunited with this team. It is like, you know, I grew up with these movies and like time spent with like Harrison Ford doing his Indiana Jones shtick is always going to be good fun. But yeah, 3 in retrospect. I mean, perfectly nice time at the movies, but not one that's kind of going to rank highly. Yeah, I think I'm probably with you, Shay. I think this is maybe 4 out of 5 or 3, somewhere around that in terms of Indiana Jones movies. Next up, it's Mother and Son.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
In the late 1980s, Rose moves from the Ivory Coast to Paris with her two young sons. Spanning 20 years from their arrival in France to the present day, this film is a moving chronicle of the construction and deconstruction of a family. So, Shay, this is obviously a much smaller film, but kind of dealing, I guess, with some similar themes of like time passing and found family. I mean, what did you make of it?
I really, really liked this film. It's weird to say where it was like there was a lot in this film that was very stirring, very haunting, because obviously it's kind of the relationship between a mother and her sons over time and kind of how it comes together and then how it slowly starts to fall apart. And it really just explores in some ways the kind of inherent transference of some of like your, you know, from a parent to a child, their traits, how some of their decisions can affect that child and how they process and see the world. So there was a lot in there that they really pack into what is, again, like quite a small film and quite a subtle film. It's a film that, again, doesn't necessarily shout about a lot of things. And there are, you know, also some themes because they have come from the Ivory Coast to France, where it kind of looks at the progressing changes in attitudes towards immigration. And again, these things are kind of threaded in. There's not really a big song and dance made about them, but it's just more like context for the viewer that, again, enriches and further kind of strengthens some of what Rose, who the mother is, some of her decision making, some of how she feels at the time, and then juxtaposes that with how her sons are now living, because of course, spoiler alert, attitudes towards immigrants got worse. So kind of seeing how things were when she first came and how that affected her and her young sons, and now how it affects her sons as they are adults. But yeah, just really, really skillfully done. So heavy subject matter, does have some really great moments that do show joy and levity that I really liked. But yeah, I really enjoyed it.
Adam, you equally enthused?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, I think Shay's captured it really nicely there. It's a film which kind of always has a really strong sense of like time and place, even when it's spanning this, you know, like 20 years, is it? It's quite a long time. And it's quite long, right? It's about 2 hours. But it doesn't kind of rush through that. I like the way that it sort of weaves in and out of the characters' lives, and you get other characters kind of dropping in and out. And there's a lot which happens kind of off camera, right? There's a lot which you don't get to see, which I think speaks volumes to the kind of characters' experiences. Only thing I'd say is, like, I think the actor who plays Rose, is it Annabelle Lengron, is just so good. And I do think, although obviously, you know, the clues in the title as to the kind of the main subjects of this film, I think the second half of the film focuses more on the son, and she takes a bit more of a back seat, but she is just so phenomenal in this. I think the film loses a little bit of kind of momentum when she's off screen. And maybe that's mainly because she's just in every scene in the first sort of hour or so of the film, and she's just so powerful, and you kind of really, yeah, you really kind of like empathize with her and kind of feel her experience. And that's not to sort of take anything away from the performance of the actor who plays the titular son, but I just think by comparison, I think she's just so strong. But yeah, I'm with Shay on this one. It's very, very pleasantly surprised with this one.
I mean, you've got two pairs of actors playing the sons, right? I mean, did you, Shay, were you kind of impressed by how they seemed like the same person in both kind of iterations?
I mean, they don't necessarily resemble each other physically, but that's fine. I think because the passage of time between, so when we first meet the two sons with their mother, they are like very young. So I think the youngest son, Ernest, looks probably no, like
he's an infant,
five, like, four, yeah, maybe five,
that,
four,
I'd
five,
say, like, yeah
maybe. And then Jean, he looks to be maybe, is he less than 10? They're not crazy specific about, so when it first starts it's 1989, but then as they move through time we never really know what year it is. There are maybe some snippets that you can guess at, but they don't necessarily make it clear how old the sons have become. But there's quite a significant time jump from when we first see the sons to the next set of sons that we see. So they're more teenaged. I feel like Jean might even be an adult or a young adult. I'm not entirely sure because he seems to be engaging in stuff that a young adult would engage in, but teenagers also do, so I'm not entirely sure. But yeah, it's quite a big change. But again, I think there isn't necessarily a lot of similarity because their life circumstances have changed quite a bit. So the Jean that we see at the beginning, who again is kind of left to be a child, is very different from the teenage / young adult Jean, who now is needing to emulate a parental figure because some of the choices that Rose has made mean that she's not there all of the time. So that's very different. But I do feel for Ernest, he maybe is the most stays in, like the most similar potentially until the end. And again, I think some of that is what the story or the narrative is about, where it's kind of the mother and son is the mother and the oldest son. And in some ways, the youngest son is shielded from a lot of those things. He is affected, but not in the same way as the eldest son is in some ways, because, you know, some of the mistakes or perceived mistakes of the mother can sometimes impact the oldest first before it then filters down and reaches the youngest. So I thought that was pretty interesting.
Yeah, the dynamic between the two brothers, especially as they get older as well, is really interesting. And there's quite a kind of tragic departure of the older brother at one point. And yeah, he's played by an actor called Stefan Back, who listeners may recognise from appearing in the last two Wes Anderson films. So he's in The French Dispatch in the Timothy Chalamet story. And then he's in Asteroid City as well, briefly.
I thought I recognised him. I thought he was brilliant.
Yeah, he's really good.
You mentioned there's this kind of like political element to the story, where it's kind of looking at the way that immigrants are being received over the course of these 20 years. I mean, was that kind of like done in a heavy-handed way, or do you think that like the sort of messaging of it all worked within the story?
I don't think it was heavy-handed. Again, like I think it was like small wisps, like you might hear on the TV, like who was the president at the time, like Jacques Chirac and different policies. And then there is a scene towards the end of the film where one of the sons has a direct interaction with the police that is clearly like quite prejudiced. But aside from that, it's not necessarily something that I think was overdone. I also don't think it was underdone. So I think it is important to the story, but I think you get just enough of it to let the actual story, again, it's just framework. It's really just about the relationship between a mother and her sons. And that is what is spotlighted, rightfully so, I think.
Hmm. And I think early on when you see, so they come over and initially stay with their kind of relatives of some kind, I think. And there's this sense, so Rose's character gets a job at working as a cleaner, but you get this sense of like, the rules that might apply to kind of like anglicized, like white French people. They're having to follow almost like a different set of rules, right? And she's constantly being kind of reprimanded at home by these older relatives who've been there and experienced it, and saying like, look, you need to kind of like buck your ideas up a little bit, and we've got you this job. And I just think the little subtle ways of communicating between those characters was really interesting, and kind of hinted at the kind of the bigger picture really of like what that experience is like. And just this idea that you can't put a kind of foot out of line, basically. And yeah, I thought that was like really, really interesting the way it kind of sets it up. And as you said, it's not at all heavy handed in that sense.
We should get some scores on this before we look at some perhaps slightly more problematic fare. Shade, you want to go first? In anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yes. So in anticipation, I'll give it a 4, because I am very interested in that subject matter. I'd heard good things about it, and yeah, it just sounded very fascinating. And I quite like stories and narratives that kind of follow the passage of time from different characters' perspectives. So that would be anticipation. Enjoyment, I would give it a 3. I think it was a really skillfully built story. There are a lot of scenes in it that were really transfixing. I do feel like potentially towards the end, the pace kind of slowed a little bit, which is again when we were dealing with the youngest son, but I did think it finished quite strong. And also, you know, some of the themes are quite haunting, so there was only so much I could wildly enjoy. But in retrospect, a 4. I think it was really well acted, and definitely a film that will probably stick with me for quite a while.
Adam, what about you?
Yeah, I'd say maybe 3 in anticipation. I had seen the director's previous filming at Cannes about 5 or 6 years ago, Jeune Femme, which is worth seeking out as well. So kind of familiar with her work, but probably a 3, and then 4 for enjoyment, and maybe a 3 for in retrospect.
Huh. Why did it kind of slightly cool as after it finished?
Just think in terms of, yeah, sort of what Shay mentioned about the pacing and yeah, I just think narratively, I think it's kind of very compelling in the moment, and as you say, kind of like dealing with some like very heavy themes in a very with a very light touch, which is not an easy thing to pull off at all. But yeah, just didn't quite kind of hold me for the full duration. So probably not one I would like rush to revisit just for that reason.
Well, next up we get to revisit something that really was very different in my memory than it was in actuality. It's Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom. In 1935, Indiana Jones is tasked by Indian villagers with reclaiming a rock stolen from them by a secret cult beneath the catacombs of an ancient palace. So, Adam, this is a wild film. I don't know what I remembered, but like even within like the first 20 minutes, it's so frantic and so much happens. And yeah, couldn't be made today for multiple reasons.
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, it's a curious one, isn't it? Because obviously in Raiders, you kind of end up with Indy and Marion kind of riding off into the proverbial sunset. And this one then, I think because for whatever reason, Karen Allen's not in this second one, they shift it and make it actually a prequel. So it's the second in the series, but it actually takes place before Raiders. And they introduce Kate Capshaw's character, who is Mrs. Spielberg as well, to proceedings in this amazing opening set piece, which is like this song and dance number. I mean, Anything Goes is like the name of the number, and it very, very fittingly sets the kind of tone for the rest of the film, I think. And yeah, then you're kind of whisked off. I mean, the whole setup of them just kind of like crash landing in the middle of it's like northern India, I guess, because they've come over like the Himalayas.
Yeah, he says when they land, kind of, where are you? And he sees a van and says, we're in India.
Yeah, exactly.
Based on his appearance.
it's just a kind of totally incidental that they just happen to rock up in this Indian village. And it's, I don't know, I think it lacks, because and actually we get just to backtrack and go back to the Isle of Destiny. You know, I think the great thing, well, the thing they probably established very early on in the writer's room is like, let's get back to basics and like what people love about Indy, which is like him punching Nazis basically and searching for kind of lost artifacts, etc. And I think Temple of Doom sort of strays from that formula a little bit too much. The kind of de facto bad guy in this, he's just a very kind of broadly caricaturish character. And you know, the sort of films, I mean, you said you couldn't make this today. I think that it's kind of portrayal of Indian culture generally, Hindu phobia and like Islamophobia and a general kind of lack of understanding about any kind of non-Western cultures is like a long established issue with kind of Hollywood and even, you know, more recently that's been an issue. But here, I think it really stands out. Not so much that it's like perpetuating certain stereotypes. It just has a complete willful ignorance towards the culture that it's depicting, right? I mean, the whole kind of dining feast scene where they're eating like chilled monkey brains and, you know, cutting open the belly of a snake, and it's almost like kind of farcical the way it's portraying this. And to be honest, I think beyond the kind of Hindu phobia and the kind of racism of the film, it's like just not very good. I mean, like just the plot is just not very good, and it's not really interesting. It has some great characters. I think Short Round is a kind of all time indie character, and I think the opening set piece, as I mentioned, is one of my favorites, if not my favorite in the whole series. But I think it just, doesn't really hold up narratively.
Yeah, it does have that kind of fun, propulsive energy of it's just always moving at such a pace and like, you know, it kind of doesn't take its foot off the gas. But I don't know, I remember the chilled monkey brains, but like at one point somebody's just like eating live eels out of the belly of someone. And there's a sort of good natured side of things that I think you can forgive, particularly in Raiders. But like this, it seemed to like find India like repulsive in a way that was like quite difficult to forgive. I mean, Shay, you've seen them all. Does this seem to have? I mean, how does this kind of rank? I haven't seen a couple of them for a while, but like, are they all like this? No, I can't imagine they are.
So it being my first time watching, so the actual synopsis for this, when I was going back to actually watch them, it didn't actually tell me what the film was about. It just said this film has outdated attitudes, which I was kind of like, wow, okay, what am I in for? Yeah, definitely couldn't make that today. Something that stood out to me was, I think after they've crash landed in the village that they end up in, when Indy and I think her name's Willie, and Short Round come to the village, and then it's kind of just like all the villagers just kind of crowding and surrounding them and touching them as these kind of white saviors. It was all very strange. It gave me a flash, well, it's not a flashback, I guess a flash forward to Game of Thrones, when they did something very similar with Daenerys Targaryen. When she comes, I cannot remember where she saved, but she comes and then it's just a bunch of like poor, darker skinned people uplifting her. And I was kind of like, did they use the Temple of Doom as the template for this? And did they not look online and see that that was not? Anyway, it kind of gave me flashes of that. On the positives, I did like Short Round. I really did. It was also an interesting experience, given that Everything Everywhere All at Once was one of my favourite films last year. So that's the Kihi Kwan that I know. And then watching this and seeing him as a very young child and introducing, and I was like, oh, it's Oscar winner. That was pretty cool. But I think he was definitely a highlight in the film. And I kind of was sad when I found out that he wasn't in The Last Crusade. I mean, it makes sense because chronologically, the films are different, but I was sad that I was only going to get to see Short Round once, for sure.
I mean, you mentioned that, like, Kate Capshaw, who's playing Willie, is Steven Spielberg's wife. I'm amazed that this is the role you'd cast your wife in. Like, the movie seems to think that she is not great. Like, well, everything seems to be at her expense, aside from the musical number.
I don't think they were married at that time.
I think this might be the film they met on, and then they were married a few years later. But no, it's a weird role. I think it's probably the of all the kind of female characters, throughout the series, it's probably the weakest role, I'd say, or the most kind of thankless role for her. And I actually think she plays the character with quite a lot of like charm and moxie, and you know, it's just like anything that's a kind of flaw, say, of Indy's character, like him being squeamish around bugs and snakes and things, is kind of like amplified to an almost like irritating degree with her character. And I think, yeah, she is constantly kind of getting in the way and having to be saved. And you know, even in that opening scene, she's portrayed as being extremely materialistic and chasing this diamond across the floor while Indy's trying to get this antidote to the poison he's just consumed. So yeah, I think it's a bit of a kind of thankless role, to be honest, but she does, I'd say Kate Capshaw does her best with it. And yeah, you know, you're talking about the kind of sense of propulsion and momentum with this film, and I think you do get that in kind of spurts, but there's this whole sequence when they're kind of inside the temple, essentially in this kind of cavernous set. And I think that's where the film really kind of falls down. It's just it spends so long really kind of navigating its way out of that, and it's just quite boring, that whole sequence. I think it picks up a little bit later on when they escape and they're kind of being chased, and there's the whole, you know, crossing the river on the rope bridge. And actually, I remember as a child, one of the things that really like terrified me about this film, and I would kind of have to close my eyes watching it, was the guys being eaten by the crocodiles at the end. Just the kind of cutaways to the crocodiles writhing around with like rags in their mouths and stuff was, as a child, I was like, there is no worse death that could befall anyone than that. I remember that sticking in my mind quite clearly.
Maybe getting your heart kind of like pulled out of your chest, that's pretty bad.
that's bad, but it's so cartoonishly done, right? I think even as a kid watching it, I was like, well, that doesn't make sense. You can't really do that.
I was thinking it's a bit scary for children. I was kind of like, I think Raiders definitely has like, you know, some scary bits, like face melters aside. But I did think, because the tone of this is so dark, I was kind of like, a child watching, well, I guess like a youngish child watching this, I don't think so. But there's also a few, as well as the crocodiles, the one where one of the lead henchmen, who is definitely not an actual Indian person, and it's quite clear, meets quite a sticky end. And I think that was a bit distressing.
Yeah, it kind of doesn't make sense to me also as a prequel, because I feel like in Raiders, we're taking this man who's kind of a man of facts and of science, and he's kind of actually has to like accept this level of like that there's kind of magic in the world in a way. And then when it comes to Temple of Doom, he's like quite up for like kind of going along with like, oh yeah, magic stones and like all of these human, yeah, totally fine. Doesn't really question it.
But he's sort of heard of what they are, right? When they say, oh, they've stolen our magic stones, and he's like, oh yeah, I know what they are.
And they've taken the children.
Quite lazy. Yeah, and they've taken the children. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I think that was what made me go, oh, okay, well, even as kind of grouchy as Indiana is, like, somebody think of the children. So that's how he kind of ends up going along to go and help. But again, it is very nonsensical.
Yeah, and like you say, the whole kind of white savior complex that the film has is just quite out of keeping with the rest of the series. I think it definitely is the kind of nadir, I would say. And actually, you're going by your ranking earlier, this for me on rewatch was like probably the bottom of the pile, even after Crystal Skull and Dial of Destiny.
Did I put this at the bottom? I can't remember, or was it Crystal Skull? Maybe I put, because I think the thing that I did like about this film was I really liked the minecart chase. I thought that was really cool. Yeah, I liked that. And then that alone would be pretty cool. But then it goes into the whole bridge thing. So I felt like the action scenes were probably, right at the end, were probably my favorite, maybe quite high up in the series. So I think if I put this above Crystal Skull, that might be why. But now, given everything that we've just listed off, I'm like, maybe not. But yeah.
Yeah, I think Crystal Skull actually does hold up favourably, because like as much as people made fun of the whole kind of fridge in the nuclear blast, I think kind of a raft off a out of a plane is like, I take my odds with the fridge.
They go out on this raft and just hit the sort of peaks and then just carry on, right? They just cruise down this mountain. It's amazing.
And then I think they fall off another giant cliff.
Yeah, right. Crystal Skull, that the whole thing as well with it being about aliens, I sort of remember on the first watch the film not showing its hand as early as it does. I mean, pretty much in the opening scene where they're in this archive and they uncover this box and this odd looking skeleton. Maybe it's just in kind of retrospect because I know it's about aliens, but straight away you're like, oh, it's about aliens. Like, you know, it's quite early on that they kind of reveal that. So I think you kind of have to just kind of go with it on that one. And the nuke scene. I mean, you know, maybe the only thing you'd say about that is it's a bit over the top in terms of how he's like blasted, you know, 100 miles in sort of certain direction. I think if he'd have just kind of stayed in the fridge and the whole town had been like completely decimated, that would have been quite funny. But I think that's probably the thing with that film I'd say on rewatch is like every single set piece is just taken to like, they just turn up the dial a little bit too far each time.
Well, I'm no scientist, but yes, the fact that this man in this recent one is in his 80s doesn't seem quite right, even when you just take in radiation poisoning. But yes, not to get too dark, I'm very glad that Harrison Ford is still around and making these movies, even if I think maybe this one should be buried in a vault. Before we wrap up, we've got one last thing. You guys are going to do some non-movie recommendations. Shay, do you want to go first? What is the non-movie you suggest people check out?
Non-movie, I'll go TV show. So if you guys aren't already watching Abbott Elementary, it's on, I think, Disney Plus. It's basically a like network comedy made by the amazing Quinta Brunson, which is set in a elementary school in Philadelphia. I'm trying to think what else to say other than it is laugh out loud hilarious. Like, it's just a show that actually just brings joy, and not necessarily in the Ted Lasso, old Ted Lasso, not season 3 Ted Lasso, in the overtly sugary way, but again, it's just teachers doing their best with what they have. Like, it's a great cast. Cheryl Lee Ralph is great. Like, Tyler James Williams is great. Like, it again, like, everyone is just wonderful. It has a lot of really cool life lessons, but yeah, it's just a really good time, and it's only half an hour, so I would 100% recommend it if you haven't seen it already.
Oh, I'm so with you with the Quinta Brunson love. I first saw her on the first series of HBO's Black Lady Sketch Show, and I loved that series. And then she leaves, and I kept watching it again and being like, why have I not laughed one time in like 5 episodes? And it turns out I didn't like the show. I just liked her.
Yeah, I think I watched like an episode of it, and then I was like, yeah, it's okay. But Quinta Brunson is everything she touches, just love.
Oh, brilliant writer, brilliant performer. I mean, wishing only the best things for her. Adam, what about you? What's your non-movie recommendation?
I just went to see the Helmut Avklint and Piet Mondrian exhibition at the Tate, which I'd recommend if you're interested in that kind of thing. I mean, it's I'd say definitely stronger in terms of her work that is exhibited there. That they have in the last room, there's like the 10 largest series that she did, which kind of, yeah, captures a sort of the whole scope of human life cycle. And it's, but her work in general was like kind of very spiritual and very, you know, very abstract. And yeah, I think definitely, I mean, they kind of say at the start of the exhibition that these two artists, even though one was living in Sweden, one was based in the Netherlands, it's like they didn't actually know each other and weren't really familiar with each other's work. So any kind of overlaps in themes are sort of purely coincidental, but very much kind of like of the moment. You know, there's a lot going on with like jazz music and you know, in literature and all these other kind of artistic disciplines. So it's kind of interesting seeing their work side by side. But I think, yeah, I came out of it anyway thinking like I'd seen a few of her pieces in various exhibitions before, but seeing the full kind of scope of her career and artistic development, and then seeing those kind of final 10 huge artworks at the end, it was like really, really kind of amazing. I think you could just like spend an afternoon just in that one room alone. It's pretty astonishing.
Oh, that sounds great. Is that Tate Britain or Tate Modern?
Tate Modern. I think it's until early September, so it's on for a little while.
God, yeah. One of my favorite things in the world to do is walk across that previously wobbly bridge into the Tate Britain. It just brings so much joy. You're always like, London, you are a beautiful, beautiful place, and you know, couple of hours later you're disavowed of that notion, but for that moment at least,
until you fall in love again.
So if you've got thoughts on these films, you can email truthandmovies@tco.london or tweet us at lwlies. Next week, Pixar returns with Elemental, and we spoke to its director, Peter Son. The Tobacco Force heroes must save the world in Smoking Causes Coughing,
And for Film Club, it's Pixar's debut, Toy Story. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Truth and Movies is hosted by me, Layla Latif, and my guests this week were Adam Woodward and Cheyenne Buncey. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High-quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.